Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are so glad to have you with us. Today, we're shifting gears a little.
We are.
Usually, we take a really broad look at a topic, but today we are on a very specific mission. We've pulled together this massive stack of resources, articles, syllabus notes, all focused entirely on topic Area 3, data and testing.
That's right. And look, if you are a student out there, specifically prepping for the R050 final exam, this deep dive is, well, it's practically written for you. This is the real nuts and bolts of the curriculum.
But even if you aren't sitting an exam, I'd argue you should stick around.
Oh, definitely.
Because what we're talking about today is, I mean, it's essentially the nervous system of the modern world. Yeah. We're peeling back the curtain on how the digital world actually functions.
It is the nervous system, absolutely. Mm-hmm. When people hear data and testing, their eyes glaze over a bit. They think it's just spreadsheets and, you know, checklists and boring admin work. But that's such a mistake.
I want to start with a question for you and for everyone listening. Have you ever just stopped to think about the invisible life cycle of a single piece of information? Like, how does a random number just floating in the ether eventually turn into a decision that changes a business or maybe even changes your entire day?
And more importantly,
and how do we make sure that number doesn't break the entire system along the way?
That is the core question. You know, when we look at IT curriculums, especially something like the R050, it's so easy to get bogged down in just memorizing definitions.
Right. Just rote learning.
And you need to know your definitions. Absolutely. You need the marks. But the real value here is understanding that flow. Mm. How do we take some raw input, store it safely, check that it's not garbage, and then prove the whole machine works?
Exactly. So here's our roadmap for this deep dive. We're going to start at the very beginning, the alchemy of turning raw data into actual information.
Okay.
Then we'll look at the hunt, how we actually collect it. We'll move on to gatekeeping, how we keep it accurate with validation and verification.
A crucial one.
Then the vault, where do we put it all? And finally, the ultimate test proving it actually works.
It sounds like quite a journey, but it's a logical one. Every step really depends on the last.
So let's jump right into section one. The sources all call this information and data. And I think a lot of people use those words interchangeably. I know I do sometimes.
Everyone does.
Well, they send me the data or send me the info. And I mean the same thing. Is there actually a difference?
There is a massive difference. In fact, in the IT world, and especially for this exam, confusing them is a cardinal sin. If you write data is information on your paper, you are losing marks instantly.
Wow.
Think of it this way. Data is the raw material. It's
right.
Unprocessed. It's just text, numbers, symbols. On its own, it has no meaning at all. It's unorganized.
Okay, let's unpack that. The source material uses a great example, the number 15.
Right. Take the number 15. If I just write 15 on a sticky note and stuck it to your monitor, what is it?
Well, it's just 15. It could be anything. It could be my age, if I were very, very lucky.
Ah.
It could be the date, the number of cars in the car park.
Exactly. The number of petals on a flower. Until we apply meaning to it, it is useless. It's just potential.
So if data is the raw material, information is what happens when we, what, cook it?
Precisely. Information is data plus meaning. But the source material gives us a really specific formula that students really need to memorize. It's deeper than just adding meaning.
Oh.
The formula is information equals data plus meaning plus structure plus context.
Ooh, structure and context. Those feel like the secret ingredients. Let's break those down. The source uses a date example, right? 050124.
Yes, so 050124 is the data. Just a string of numbers. If I tell you it's a date, that's the meaning. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay. But then we add structure. We add those slash separators so it reads 050124. Now it's, you know, readable to a human eye.
Okay, so that's structure. But what about context? Why is that separate?
This is where it gets really interesting and where real world errors happen all the time. Context is everything. If you're in the UK, 050124 is the 5th of January, 2024. But if the context is, this is a US formatted date, suddenly that same string of numbers is May 1st, 2024.
That is a huge difference, especially if that date is a deadline for an assignment or an expiration date on medicine or something.
Exactly. Without context, information can be completely misinterpreted. So for the exam, you have to remember that equation. Data plus meaning plus structure plus context, information.
Got it. Okay, before we leave the raw data behind, we have to touch on data types. The sources list a few specific categories that come up. I'm going to throw them at you. You give me the quick definition and maybe why we care. Ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Alphanumeric.
Okay, so that's any sequence with only letters and numbers. Think of a license plate or a username like a Richards 3. It doesn't usually include symbols like question marks or exclamation points.
So how's that different from text?
Text is broader. Text is the catch-all. It can contain any character on your keyboard. Letters, numbers, symbols, spaces, the lot. If you're writing an email address or a full sentence, that's text.
Okay, next one. Boolean. I've always loved the sound of that word.
It's the simplest one, but you could argue it's the most powerful for computers. It represents one of two options. True or false, yes or no. One or zero.
So why bother? Why not just type yes?
Efficiency. Storing a single one or zero takes up almost no space compared to the word yes, and computers can process it instantly. Think of a checkbox for invoice paid. It's either done or it isn't.
Nice. Okay, next up, date.
Pretty self-explanatory, but the format is what matters. DDMMYYYY. The computer needs to know it's a date so it can do calculations like, you know, figuring out how many days are between two points in time.
And finally, numeric. But the source breaks this down even more, doesn't it? You can't just say number.
No, you have to be specific. You have integers, which are whole numbers.
Yeah.
You'd use this for things you can't split, like 5 items sold. You can't sell 5.3 items.
Right.
Then you have decimal or real numbers, which have a decimal point, like 4.3 kilometers or height, 1.8 meters.
And I assume currency and percentage are just variations of that?
Yes, and they have their own special formatting rules. Being specific about which numeric type you need is a classic exam question. If it asks for number of sisters and you select decimal, you'll probably lose the mark. You can't have half a sister.
Good point. Okay, so we know what data is. Now we need to go get it. Which brings us to section two, the hunt, or, you know, more formally, data collection methods.
Right. And again, we have a major split here. Two broad types, primary and secondary. The distinction is all about ownership.
The difference being?
Primary data collection is when you or your organization collect the data yourselves. You are the source. It's fresh.
Okay.
Secondary data collection is when you use data that someone else has already collected. You're borrowing it.
Okay. Let's look at primary methods first. The source lists three big ones: email, online questionnaires, and interviews. Let's talk email. I send out a form link by email. Why would I do that?
Well, it's fast. You can send it all over the world in seconds. It's also trackable. You can often see if people opened it. And the responses are electronic, so they can be automatically collated. You're not sitting there typing things up by hand.
But there has to be a catch, right?
Think about your own inbox. Junk folders. Spam filters. It is so easy to ignore an email. Response rates can be terribly low. Plus, you're assuming the recipient has the digital skills to even respond.
True. Okay, what about online questionnaires?
These are generally great for getting high response rates compared to paper. If you hand someone a clipboard on the street, they might just walk away.
Yeah.
But people are much more likely to click a few buttons online. And again, no handwriting to try and decipher.
Oh, deciphering handwriting is the worst. But surely there's a downside.
Design time. Building a really effective digital survey takes a while. You have to make sure the questions aren't confusing. And obviously, you need devices to complete them in the first place.
Right. Now, the third one feels very different. Interviews. This is face-to-face or maybe over video. This feels like the premium option.
It is the personal touch. The biggest advantage here is that you can see people's reactions. You can have follow-up questions.
Oh, okay.
If I ask you, do you like this app?
Yeah.
And you sort of hesitate before saying yes, I can ask, why did you hesitate?
Yeah.
You get much richer, more considered responses.
And I imagine it's a nightmare to organize.
It is. It's so time consuming to arrange. It takes a long time to actually do.
Yeah.
And then analyzing the data is hard.
Yeah.
How do you put a 30-minute conversation into a spreadsheet? It's much harder than a yes-no answer.
So that's primary. Now, secondary, using other people's work. The source mentions books and magazines, websites, and government statistics.
Okay, so books and magazines. The pro here is reliability. Usually a book has been edited, proofread, checked by a publisher. You can generally trust it more than some random blog. However, they're static. The second a book is printed, that data is frozen in time. If you're researching the latest smartphone specs, a book from 2 years ago is completely useless.
That makes sense. What about websites? That feels like the go-to for everyone now.
It is. Huge volume of information, so easy to access. But I call this the Wild West.
Uh-huh.
Reliability is a massive, massive issue. Anyone can publish anything. Bias is a real problem. You have to be so careful checking your sources.
And finally, government statistics, like census data.
Usually seen as very reliable and often free, which is great.
Yeah.
But the data sets can be overwhelming. They are huge. You might have to wade through gigabytes of Excel sheets just to find the one statistic you actually need.
So pick your poison carefully, depending on what you need. Okay, moving on to section three. We've collected our data. Now we need to make sure it's not garbage. This is gatekeeping, and we need to talk verification and validation.
This is arguably the most important distinction in this entire topic. If you take one thing away from this deep dive, let it be this. Verification and validation are not the same thing.
I used to think they were synonyms, so lay it out for us.
Okay. Validation checks if the data is sensible or reasonable. Does it meet the rules we set?
Right.
Verification checks if the data is accurate or consistent with the original source.
Okay, let's start with verification. How do we verify data?
Two main ways mentioned. First, manual checking. That's just proofreading. You enter data from a paper form into the computer, then you read it against the original paper to see if it matches.
Simple, but slow.
Very slow. The second way is double entry. You know when you sign up for a website and it asks you to confirm password by typing it a second time?
Yes, and it's always so annoying.
It is annoying, but it's a classic verification technique. The computer compares the two entries. If they don't match exactly, it rejects it. It catches the typo before it's saved. That is verification, making sure it's consistent.
Okay, so that's checking accuracy. Now, validation. Checking if data is sensible. The source gives us a whole toolkit of checks. I'm going to run through them. You give us a real-world example.
Let's do it.
Data type check.
That's making sure you enter a number, not a letter, in a quantity field.
Mm.
If I ask how many items, and you type out three as a word, the system should stop you. It ensures the computer can actually do math with the input.
Format check.
Postcodes are the classic example. SW1A1DF. The system checks for that specific pattern of letters and numbers. If you just type a random jumble, it blocks you.
Input mask.
This forces a structure on you. Think of a phone number field where the parentheses for the area code are already there on the screen and you just fill in the blanks. You literally can't type it wrong.
Links check.
Passwords must be at least 10 characters long. If you type 9, it fails. It ensures a minimum standard is met.
Limited choice or lookup.
Drop-down menus. If you're selecting a country you pick from a list, it stops you spelling France wrong or inventing a country that doesn't exist.
Presence check.
That's the annoying red asterisk that says required field.
Mm.
You cannot leave this blank. It makes sure you don't submit a form without, say, a surname.
And finally, the range check.
This is a big one for the exam. Checking if a number falls between a preset minimum and maximum. For example, a website for teenagers might have a range check on age, strictly 13 to 19. You type 12 or 20, it blocks you. It keeps the data within sensible boundaries.
Okay, so we've validated and verified our data. It's clean. Now, section four, the vault. Where do we keep it?
Storage. And this seems simple, but there are important nuances here about where the data physically or logically lives. You have to choose the right vault for the job.
Let's talk internal storage first. Inside the computer, we have the classic battle, HDD versus SSD.
Right. The magnetic hard disk drive, or HDD, is the old school tech.
Yeah.
It has spinning magnetic platters inside. They're cheaper and you can get huge storage capacities, terabytes, for not much money. But they have moving parts, so they can break if you drop your laptop, and they are much slower to access data.
Versus the solid-state drive, the SSD.
Which is what most modern laptops use. No moving parts. It uses flash memory, so it's effectively like a giant USB stick.
Mm.
It's much faster, way more durable, and uses less power. But per gigabyte, they're more expensive.
Then we have cloud storage. Everyone talks about the cloud.
Yeah. And it's important to remember, the cloud isn't magic. It isn't floating in the sky. It's just a logical location. Your data is just sitting on a physical server somewhere else in the world, managed by a company like Google or Microsoft.
What are the big pros and cons there?
Pros, you can access it from anywhere with an internet connection. It's brilliant for collaboration. You just send a hyperlink instead of a massive attachment. And the provider handles all the backups and security.
But the cons?
You're relying on their security. There are, you know, trust issues. And obviously, if your internet goes down, you can't get to your files. You are completely tethered to connectivity.
Right. What about external storage? The stuff we plug in.
You've got your portable HDDs or SSDs.
Mm-hmm.
Great for backups, but you have to carry them around. You can drop them. You can lose them. Then you have USB flash drives.
The little sticks we always lose in the washing machine.
Exactly. Small, cheap, very compatible, but incredibly easy to steal or break. And then for the more tech savvy, you have the NAS network attached storage.
That sounds fancy. What is it?
It's basically a little dock full of hard drives that connects to your Wi-Fi router at home. It's like having your own personal cloud server in your house.
So you keep control.
You keep control of the data. It's physically in your house, but you can still access it remotely. The catch is you have to set it up and maintain it all yourself.
Okay. We are in the home stretch now. Section five, We have the data, it's clean, it's stored, we've built a system around it. How do we prove it works?
Testing. This is the final safeguard. The whole goal is to ensure the solution is error-free, that it meets all the requirements, and crucially, that it doesn't drive the user completely crazy.
The source outlines specific types of test data that students really need to know. And there's a specific example here that I think trips people up. Let's role play this so everyone gets it. Imagine a system that accepts ages from 13 to 120.
Right, 13 to 120. That is our valid range.
Okay, walk us through the three types of test data using that range.
Okay, first you have valid data. This is just normal data that should work. So if the range is 13 to 120, a valid test would be entering the age 50. It's right in the middle. It should be accepted. Simple.
Easy enough.
Next is extreme or boundary data. This is where points are won or lost in the exam.
Right, because I always assume extreme means something crazy, like entering a million.
No, yeah. That is the trap. That's exactly the trap. Extreme data is data that is right on the very edge of the limit, but it's still valid. It's there to test the boundaries.
So in our 13 to 120 example.
The extreme data would be 13 on 20. Students often think extreme means too much. It doesn't. It means at the extreme edge of what is allowed. The system must accept 13 and 120.
Got it. So what do we call the data that's meant to fail?
That is invalid or erroneous data. That would be NANIST 1 or 121 or even typing the word 50. The system should reject all of these.
So valid, normal, extreme, edge, but still valid, and invalid, fail. That is a key takeaway.
Absolutely. If your system accepts 121, your programming is wrong. And that's why we test those boundaries so carefully.
Now, besides just checking the data inputs, there are two broader types of testing mentioned. Technical testing and user testing.
Technical testing is usually done by the developers. You know, does it work? Does the menu open? Is it fast? Does the calculation give the right answer? It's checking the mechanics of the machine.
And user testing.
This is the human element. You get real users, people who have never seen it before, to try and break it, or just to see if it makes sense to them.
Why is that so important? Why can't the developers just do it all?
Because developers know how the system is supposed to work. They built the maze, so they know the way out. Users don't.
Good point.
A user might try to click something that isn't a button, or they might get completely confused by the wording on a screen. Technical testing confirms it works. User testing confirms it is usable.
That distinction is huge. You can have a perfectly bug-free piece of software that nobody knows how to use.
Exactly.